Today is January 27th, 1994. This is Margaret Van Cleve. I will be interviewing Mark Ringstad, senior member of the Pioneer Ringstad family. Also present is his wife, Rose Ringstad. We are recording in the Ringstad home in the Slaterville area of Fairbanks, Alaska. This recording is being funded by a grant from Igloo No. 4 Foundation, Pioneers of Alaska. The Fairbanks was a small town of about 2,000 people when you moved here in 1926. At that time, it was barely a generation away from its origins. What are some of the earliest memories you have of Fairbanks of that particular era, such as your neighborhood, old-timers, school? I'm sure you have lots of very pleasant, unique memories of that time.
Well, in those early days, there really wasn't much to do in Fairbanks in the way of entertainment. People made their own fun, and there was no TV in town, and no, there was a radio station, but basically the entertainment was made by the people that lived here. They had the Moose Hall and the Eagles Hall, where they had dances at least once a week or so, and boxing was quite popular in those days too, and the Moose Hall and Eagles Hall would have boxing matches once or so a week. And so the people kind of made their own fun, and the kids mostly played sports, hockey and basketball. I don't know what the girls did, but the boys, if they weren't in trouble, they were playing basketball or hockey or doing something in the way of sports, you know. And the early hockey and curling took place on the Chena River. It was underneath the bridge there on below it and on both sides of it, and people watched from the bridge. And then later on, the hockey moved up to Griffin Park, and after Griffin Park, a few years there, it moved over by the Pioneer Brewery, which is now the Fairbanks North Star Brewery building. And then, of course, later on, the indoor rinks came, and as we know it today, at the University and Carlson Center and the Gold Kings. And then the curling rink moved from the river up to a building in the 800 block on 2nd Avenue. And it was there for many years up until they built the curling rink in lower 2nd Avenue. And the school, of course, with regard to the kids in school and all, our school burnt about 1932. I think I was in the 5th grade or so then, and the school classes went all over town. We wound up in the Well, we weren't. They were in the Presbyterian Church, but ours was in the American Legion building.
Where was that located?
That was right across the street from the present 5th Avenue building that the borough owns.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bank there now. Denali Bank, I believe, is there.
Or McKinley.
Right across the street. National Bank.
So most people lived fairly close to the center of town in those days.
Oh, yeah.
Wherever school was, it was within walking distance.
Yes, and it was a large school. All 12 grades were there, and it was all wooden, of course, and then when it burned, it went right to the ground. And then, now, as we know Old Main now, it's a concrete building, of course, built about 1934 or 5. But I think everybody's kind of happy to see the school building burn.
you thought you'd get a few days off.
A couple of weeks, but it didn't take them long to get you into classes.
Oh, did that happen at night? So it was Monday morning or whatever?
Yes. And you... Early in the morning, and everybody woke up and there was no school. And what else did we do?
Who were some of your teachers? Are there any of them that are still around?
Well, Miss Meyer is still around, and I believe Miss Olson is here too. We lost Annabeth Rennie a couple of years ago to a car accident, and most of the kids in town, especially the ones that are still around here, had her in one form or another, grade school, high school, or someplace, and she was loved by everyone. And our second grade teacher was the superintendent's wife, Mr. Moore. Miss Moore had our second grade teacher. Then we had Miss Rennie, which was Miss Annabeth mm-hmm. Rennie Ferguson Hanlon. And then we had Miss Young, Miss Kleiman, We can't forget our high school coach. Ray Arjo was our high school coach, and a lot of people, old-timers will remember him. He was very popular. And Wilson W. Walton from Walla Walla, Washington, was our math and physics and chemistry teacher, and everybody liked him. And he passed away about 4 or 5 years ago. And that's about it for our... Pardon? Yes, and I almost forgot our third grade teacher, Ms. Elarth. She later married a man named Pratt, who was an accountant for the FE company. And she was one of my favorite teachers.
So you had one grade per classroom. They weren't combined like...
No.
One-room school in some rural areas.
And in those grades, in those years, you either passed or you stayed in your grade. And in the first grade, we had a fellow there that was about between 5 and 6 feet tall because he'd never passed, and they didn't let him go on to the second grade. And that was a system in those days, but nowadays everybody passes. If you're a senior and graduating and you don't know math and English or anything else, why, they graduate you anyhow. So, I think it's a bad system.
So they made it tough in those days then when you were going to school.
The teachers made you learn.
So what did you do? You mentioned that you had made your own fun. What about work? Did kids have jobs in those days, delivering
yes.
the newspaper, things like that?
Yes, surprisingly they did. There was quite a bit for kids to do in those days because you didn't need a driver's license to drive a car, you know, and a lot of the kids in the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade were driving cars and trucks, and the main industry then seemed to be cutting wood because everybody in town burned wood. And so that was quite a little industry locally there, and kids could drive a truck and get a load of wood and bring it to town, deliver it to customers or whatever, and nobody checked to see if you had a license or anything, you know, so it didn't really matter. And they hauled coal and they hauled dirt and gravel with dump trucks, you know, so there was always something to do for kids. And before they were that big, of course, they were selling newspapers, you know, 4th, 5th grade.
Mm-hmm.
They sold newspapers and made a little spending money, you know.
Now,
so,
did you do any wood cutting or... things of that sort?
No, but I did get into some of the hauling, you know, with, mm-hmm. with the truck and delivering to homes after it was cut up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They'd deliver it in long logs, and then another guy would come around with a saw and saw it up. And so there was two industries there, three industries, one to cut it, one to haul it, and one to cut it up into pieces after we got it. So it was wood cutting was quite an industry in those days. In fact, our first powerhouse that the NC company had was all on wood. And they had a little railroad track that went down Barnett Street to old Weeks Field, which was the airport in those days. Mm-hmm. And it was they hauled wood in for the powerhouse.
Most of it probably came from Farmers Loop area and Chena Ridge.
Well, just all around the town until it was, you know.
Just getting further and further away.
Right. they picked the closest spots, you know, until mm-hmm. it got farther and farther away. And then after the wood... became scarce. Of course, the capitalists have got into the coal industry, you know, and they've had the railroad came through, and that's what brought my father here was the railroad. He was an accountant for the railroad, and then the coal was developed, and a lot of the wood-burning stoves in town could burn coal at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
They were designed so that they could, and so the town suddenly became burning coal all the time. And then, of course, after that, years later, why homes started going on oil, which most of the town is on right now.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about your family. Your mother and father, they met in Anchorage, I guess, when it was hardly more than a tent city.
It was a tent city, yes. I remember my mother mentioning one time that Cap Lathrop charged her $5 to take a tent and some of her personal belongings about 3 blocks in Anchorage to relocate them. And of course later on Cap became quite an industrialist in Alaska, you know. He was big in a coal mine, and he had theaters and apartment houses in Cordova and Anchorage and Fairbanks. And my father came from Volda, Norway, and my mother came from England, and she was born in Hull and raised in London. And she was in Seattle when she met three other ladies, and they were one that they read in the newspaper where this town in Alaska was giving a prize for naming a new town. And the town had become named Anchorage, and they thought they would all go up there to see what Anchorage was like. And that's how she came to go to Anchorage, and then she met my father there, and they were married. He mined across the bay from Anchorage at Hope, Alaska, for two or three seasons. And then he came back to Anchorage and worked for the railroad, and the railroad was pursuing its way up to Fairbanks here at that time. And he came along as an accountant and taking care of payrolls. And when the dead ended here in Fairbanks, why, he went to work for the FE company. And later on left the FE company and went to work for a private accountant in town and did some of his own bookkeeping.
Mm-hmm. So your mother, after your father passed away, it was about 1930, she went to work. Mm-hmm. What sort of work did she do?
She worked in American Hand Laundry, which was directly behind the old Nordale Hotel on 3rd Avenue. And it was quite popular in town, and they were very busy, and continued right up until the owner, Mrs. O'Gara, passed away. And then her nephew came up and sold the laundry and closed the estate and left.
Was that the same laundry that Clara Rust worked
at? Yes, Clara Rust worked in there.
So they must have worked together then.
Yeah, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, quite a few of the old-timers worked mm-hmm. in that American Hand Laundry. The O'Garas were wonderful people, and you couldn't help but love them. You know, they were always joking and very friendly, and everybody really liked them.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the old-timers. There are probably quite a few still here from a holdover from the early prospecting days. Do you remember any in particular that tell you some stories?
Well, of course, there was the Ween brothers, you know. I didn't know the oldest one, which was Ralph. He was killed in an airplane accident mm-hmm. when the city field was prior to the Weeks Field, which is the one I knew. It was a long extension of Cushman clear out to the Tanana River, and it was out there about maybe a quarter of a mile. But I didn't know Ralph, but I knew Sig and Fritz and Noel, and they were wonderful guys. They had quite a history of flying, and not necessarily the Weens, I suppose, but a lot of the bush pilots. I can relate to some of them there. There was Harold Gillum and Morse King and Bob Reeves, a pilot named Dorbant and Brennan, Archie Ferguson. There were lots of others, hundreds of others over the years. But they were all great guys, and they did a lot of mercy missions. They would go out in the hills and bring people in that were sick or hurt or whatever. And if a fellow was in a village out there someplace and he didn't have any money and he wanted to get to town, there was always a bush pilot that would come along and bring him to town. And they tell the story, I don't know how true it was, that the bush pilots would always carry a bottle of whiskey in the cockpit. So they knew how the plane was flying, because if they looked down and the whiskey was in the neck of the bottle, they knew they were upside down. I don't know how true that was, but they told it a lot anyhow.
I imagine a lot of the young boys around town used to see. Probably a lot of the young boys in town were very interested in flying and spent a fair amount of time watching pilots take off and land.
Yes, they were. Are we on?
Mm-hmm.
The bush pilots were quite popular. There were a lot of them, and there was lots of flying in those days because there weren't many highways, you know. And so naturally people became interested in flying. A lot of kids, still in high school, would take up flying, and several of them became professional pilots for the bigger airlines later on. Albert Peterson took up flying right out of high school here and became chief pilot for Alaska Airlines. And Eddie Steger took up flying while he was still in high school and became one of the older pilots and longtime pilots for Ween Airlines. And there were Terrence McDonald. He became a chief pilot for one of the airlines here in town. I think it was Alaska Airlines. There were a lot of local kids that became interested in flying because it was so prevalent in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And
so they would earn money to pay for lessons, or did some of them?
I don't really know how they paid for their lessons, but they probably weren't very expensive. And of course, imagine the way things went in those days. If a person wanted to fly for an airline, a local one, most of them started out with bush pilots, you know. They let them fly and take the lessons out of their salary after they became pilots. Just guessing, because most people didn't have the money in those days to take up flying and pay for them. I don't know what they charged for flying in those days. Get a friend that was a pilot, he'd probably teach you for nothing, you know.
So this is during the Depression years that you're talking about?
Yes. 32, 33, 34, mm-hmm. 35, 37 through 36.
So did you do some flying?
Well, I took it my junior year in college at the University of Alaska out here. Not to go into it commercially, but just because I thought I'd like to fly. And of course, I was busy in the Pepsi-Cola plant after I graduated from the university, and I didn't have much time to fly, and I felt that if I couldn't fly at least 2-3 times a week, and 4 or 5 would be better, you'd lose the feel of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I went up there, the ship felt strange to me, because I was only getting in there about once every other week to fly. So I gave it up because of not being able to do it.
This was the same plane, or the same type of plane?
Yes. Bachner's Phillips Field aircraft rented planes at the time, and he was at Weeks Field at that time before he went to Phillips Field. And he had an aircraft maintenance shop there, and he rented airplanes, and we could go up and check an airplane out and fly anytime we wanted after we soloed. And so after I soloed, well, I'd go up there and check an airplane out and fly around the valley here once in a while, you know. But if I didn't have an objective, like some of the other kids at Howard Miskovich soloed the same time I did. And he's mining down in Portland now. So he flies into Anchorage and Fairbanks, and he flies into Ruby once a week or so and gets mail. So he has a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really have that type of purpose for it, and so I soon gave it up. But Howard still has his own airplane and still flies, and some of the others did too. But without some objective, I lost interest. I lost interest in flying, especially, I suppose, because I didn't have the time to really do a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. So I guess when World War II came along, you were about the right age to be drafted.
Yes, I'd just started the university out here. And we got out in the spring, and I was on the drills out of Chattanooga for the FE company. And Tommy Pascavan, a friend of mine, brought me my draft notice out at 11:30 one night. I was about 5 miles from camp on one of the drills, and he finds me and hands me this draft notice. This is a friend. And he hands me this draft notice, and I didn't want to be a ground pounder, so I flew outside the next morning to join the Navy Air Corps in Seattle. And I passed everything except the colorblind test, which was enough to keep me out. So then I didn't have anything special in mind to do, and I was staying with Wesley Munson, whose father was a captain for Pan American. And he wasn't doing anything either. He's looking for something to do, and he went east of the mountains and took up an ATT course over there for civilian pilot training and became a Pan American captain himself. And I couldn't get into that because I was colorblind, so some other fellows and I signed up for the Corps of Engineers to go to Pearl Harbor. They sent us to Dutch Harbor, they took us off at Seward, and they sent us to Anchorage. So here I am back in Alaska again, and a couple months later I was telling my friend that I did get a draft notice a few months ago, so I probably should go get in the service someplace. So I quit the Corps and came up to Fairbanks and enlisted in the Air Force. Well, when I'm sitting there waiting to sign up for the Air Force, a captain come along and he says, Rick, said, what are you doing here? he was my ROTC instructor the previous season out at the university.
Oh, would that have been Russ Huber?
No, it was the Captain Dennison.
Oh.
And I said, well, I thought I'd come out here and enlist in the Air Force. He said, how would you like to enlist in the Air Force Reserve and go back to school? I said, well, that sounds pretty good. Where do you do that? He says, right here, you're my first customer. So I signed up and Air Force Reserve went back out to the university. So here I went a complete circle, you know, and then back out there again. And then in about 8 months, they put us on active duty and we went out here to Ladd Air Force Base. And I spent about a year and a half there, maybe close to 2 years, mostly playing hockey and basketball. And then they sent us back to Manchester, New Hampshire and Presque Isle, Maine, up and down the East Coast there for a year and a half, 2 years, and then the war was over and they sent us back.
So you never got away from cold country, it's
no.
Like.
Went back into Maine.
That's what I said when you were sent to the
Which
East.
Is very much like Alaska. Weather, the,
weather-wise,
the country, the trees, the, mm-hmm. the vegetation, the hills, everything is.
Well, that makes sense to send people from cold country to cold country
sure.
instead of the tropics up here, as was the case with some other units.
Yes, actually, we were only a short distance from the Canadian border at Presque Isle. It was a large Air Force base, but the town was real small.
Mm-hmm.
But we were supposed to go over to the 15th Air Force in off the coast of Spain in the Azores. And then it got too close to the end of the war. They decided maybe they weren't going to send us out there and yeah. kept us there long enough to get discharged.
So that would have been, you would have been there about 1944 on the East Coast?
Mm-hmm, 44, 45.
So at the end of the war you were still there.
Mm-hmm.
And because you were in the service, you probably qualified for GI Bill?
Yes,
to go to
came
school.
Back after the war and started school out here under the GI Bill, yes.
Mm-hmm. I noticed the class of 49 was certainly a lot bigger than the previous classes, and I suppose many of your
yeah.
classmates were
fellow
GIs.
Yes, we had 32 in high school and 32 in college, the university.
Yeah, I noticed some of your classmates are still here in the area.
Well, there's one that I wasn't very proud of. That was Jay Hammond. I think he was a disaster for the state of Alaska. But anyhow, yes, McGee, I see you know that mentioned McGee's name here a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
He's still around. Quite a few of those graduates are still around in Alaska.
So when you had the GI Bill, it was based on how many were in your family? Much you got? Or
no,
was it
whether you're in the service or not. If you were in the service, you got an honorable discharge. You got GI Bill rights.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember mm-hmm. what that was? The amount of money given to you?
I think it was $90 a month.
For the duration of the time you were in school.
Yeah.
Well, that'd just about pay for tuition.
Let's see. And it took care of it was more than that because it took care of our tuition and our books. And we weren't using very much of it. And so we had $500 that we weren't using, and I don't know if that figure is official, I haven't seen it, but Dr. Regel at the university was in the Air Force in World War II, and he was a geology professor out there. And he went back to Washington and made a deal to use this money we weren't using on the GI Bill. If you didn't use it, you didn't get it, to use it for flying. And so he worked a deal for teaching the ground courses at the university, weather and navigation and those things, and then renting airplanes at Weeks Field. And so when we got to use that $500 for that, a lot of the kids jumped into flying out at Weeks Field. And, and I was one of those guys that was using the amount of the GI Bill we weren't using for flying.
So they actually issue a check to you?
No. That was just a paper transaction at the university. We didn't handle any money.
So you never actually saw the money. It was just like a credit.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what was left over, this professor.
What you didn't use, they didn't spend.
Sounds like a good way to do business.
Yeah, right.
Oh, you were probably Vanell's last graduating class.
Yes, I was. In fact, I knew Bunnell quite well. He was a real gentleman. Everybody liked him. I remember when I first signed up, my first run-in with Dr. Bunnell, if you could call it that, I didn't sign up for ROTC because I didn't necessarily like the idea of being in the military. So, not that I had anything against the military, except that it's for people who like it, I figured. Anyhow, I didn't sign up for ROTC, and so about 2 weeks later, I see Dr. Bunnell in the hall one day, and he says, "Say, Rinkstead," he says, "you haven't signed up for ROTC." And I said, "No, I thought I'd take that my last 2 years." "Oh, no," he says, "it doesn't work that way." He says, "if you go to school here, you got to take it your first 2 years." I said, okay. Well, then I didn't sign up for it, and I was trying to figure out maybe there's some other way to get around this, and I still hadn't done it. And I saw him in the hall again about 10 days later, and he's coming towards me, and I'm going towards him, and there happened to be a set of stairs between us in the main administration building. And he said, he raised his hand, and I said, "I'm on my way up now to sign up for ROTC." And I went up those stairs and signed up for ROTC.
So that was a university requirement to graduate then?
Yeah, it was a land-grant college, and so it was required.
Oh, that's a land-grant stipulation.
Mm-hmm. All land-grant colleges, you do 2 years of ROTC, which was, you know, it's fine for guys that like it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And several of my old buddies, we had a reunion here last summer, four or five of them, that had actually, they were in their third and fourth year, so they graduated with 4 years of ROTC, so when the war broke out, they went in with an automatic commission.
Which was nice
if you have to be in the service, you know.
Yeah, get in a little higher pay.
Yeah. I don't think anybody really liked the service, but if you had to be in, well, it was better to go in as an officer. And that's what ROCC did for you, you know. So it was good in that respect.
Mm-hmm. So it was a class that you got credit for in terms of a grade, or was it just...
I don't recall getting a grade in it.
Just your presence.
It's just something you had to do because it was a requirement of the university.
Well, I guess you couldn't buck Bunnell.
No. He was good. I had Dr. Bunnell for business law, and he was very good. Very good. He was a good professor.
So in addition to being on top of everything else, he always taught a class?
Oh, yes. I taught business law. I enjoyed it, seemed to enjoy it, you know.
Mm-hmm. And he handed you your diploma?
Yes.
Where were the graduations held during those days?
In the old gymnasium.
So that would have been Signers Hall today.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which was a museum in the meantime, and finally administration.
In our day, it was a gymnasium downstairs and a library upstairs. And then later on it went to the Signers Hall.
Mm-hmm. So, and while you were attending the university, you met your future wife?
Yes, she was, she did 3 years of the university at Michigan State, and then she came up to the University of Alaska for her fourth year. Thinking she would stay 1 year and teach and then go back. But in the meantime, while we met my junior year in school, and she was graduating that year, and my senior year, she, We're back on tape. Okay. Yes, Rose graduated in 46 and taught 1 year at Palmer, and we were married in 47, and I graduated in 49. So we had our first daughter while I still had a year to go in college. And then we had, of course, 8 more after that. And in 49, the mining industry was, I graduated in mining engineering. And the mining industry was kind of in a slump in those years, and most of the action was in South America. And so I stayed and worked in the family soft drink business, which was the Pepsi-Cola and Miller High Life businesses. We distributed, manufactured, bottled, and canned Pepsi-Cola and soft drinks, and imported and was a distributorship for, had a distributorship for Miller High Life. And we served the military bases and the university and the town and all the grocery stores and bars and whatnot. We had trucks that ran around delivering. And so because of the plight of the industry, I stayed in the family business.
Did you ever do any mining in the summertime? Just kind of as...
I did mostly, most of my time was in prospecting. I did did mine on a small creek out here off of Gilmore for three summers one time. I had a helper and a D8 cat and the sluice boxes, and there was everything except enough gold.
Well, I guess it got to be pretty expensive after a while with the need for large equipment and...
Yeah, yes. Today, if you set up a halfway decent plaster mining operation, you're looking at probably $150,000 for the washing plant. Then you need mining equipment, bulldozers, bucket loaders, conveyors. So you're looking at another couple hundred thousand dollars for equipment. And then you have the camp to build, bunkhouses, cookhouse, shop for the equipment, and so you're looking at, of course, it depends on the size of the operation. You can have a one or two man operation and shovel in the sluice boxes, and you're not involved with any of that expense. But any sizable operation, you're looking at quite a bit of money for equipment and buildings and all that. So it depends upon the size of the operation that you're looking at. There's still quite a few small outfits here in the interior of Alaska, mostly up north, that are ma and pa outfits that handle themselves or maybe hire two or three people. Mm-hmm. And, of course, their expenses aren't near, like I mentioned. And I think most of them seem to make a living at it. But we don't have very many large ones like years ago when we were kids here. The FE company, I think they hired 1,200 people.
That was pretty much the main employer.
Industry in town, yes, it was.
Through the Depression. I guess World War II, though, put a stop to mining.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it really did.
Unless you were into antimony.
Yeah.
Or tungsten.
Yeah. Right. It's a shame that the Park Service had to blow up that antimony mine. It would have made a terrific tourist trap, you know, for people, mm-hmm. if they'd run the park road around that way, you know, mm-hmm. which is what they really should do.
You were also involved with the coal bunkers. Now, was that part of Usabelli coal mine?
Yes, they had that. After I got out of the Pepsi-Cola business there, I went to work for Usabelli over here at their office in town, and they shipped coal into town, and we ran it up in the bunkers there. Later on, they wanted to get rid of the town end of it, and I took over that end of it and had it for about 5 or 6 years, and then I sold it to Sourdough Heating, Sourdough Express,
mm-hmm.
and they had trucks running around town for coal and oil, and later on bought the coal bunkers from us. And are still operating it to this day.
Those have been around for quite a long time.
Yes, Cap Lathrop started them.
I was going to ask if that was part of his operation.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Before Usabelli came into business.
Yes. My half-brother worked for Cap. When he came back from England, he was about 17 or 18, and he was tamping ties for the Alaska Railroad down at Healy.
Mm-hmm.
Cap was walking down the railroad tracks one day, and he saw him, and he says, "Young fella," he says, "would you like to go to work for me in the office?" Well, you know, tamping ties isn't the best job in the world, you know, and he couldn't say yes fast enough. So he went, he quit the railroad and went to work for Cap in the office there at Healy, at Centrana in those days.
Mm-hmm.
It was, and it was underground coal mining in those days, too. Anyhow, Cap was real nice. He took him under his wing, and he sent him outside to school two or three different times to take accounting courses. And he came and became in charge of CAP's office down there, and later on he became president of the Lathrop Company and all of their holdings. And they were big in Olympia Brewing shortly after that. And of course, like I say, they had apartment houses and newspapers in Cordova and Anchorage and Fairbanks.
And theaters.
And theaters.
And so he took care of all bases.
His name was Harry Hill. And he became quite active in the company after that. I remember the one statement that I always attributed to him. He was in the Lathrop Company office here one day, and Harry and I were going out to lunch. And Cap turned around, and he turned out the lights, and he says to Harry, "Am I the only one that turns out lights around here?" So I thought that was kind of cute coming from Cap.
wasn't he called Alaska's first millionaire?
Oh, I think so, yes.
Or one that made millions and hung on to them.
Yes, and but stayed in Alaska and invested his money in
right,
Alaska.
Right, and invested. So many people left, but he certainly put his life and soul into Alaska.
Yeah. I think he got his name from a tugboat he ran out on the coast by Cordova.
Oh, the Cap.
Cap Lathrop, yeah. He certainly didn't get it from running those horses in Anchorage. I remembered that too.
So you actually knew him at different stages of your life.
Oh,
when you were a youngster in Anchorage.
Oh, yeah.
And then up here, isn't
up here.
It?
Yeah. Okay. Cap was killed by a railroad car that was coming down the tracks. And in those days, the tracks were on a grade, and when they wanted an empty car under the tipple to fill with coal, they just cut it loose. And when they were just coasting down there, they didn't make very much noise. And he was on the railroad tracks there, and this train was cut loose and was going down the tracks and hit him, run over him and killed him. And Emil Usabelli, who later became the big coal producer in the valley there, was killed in a similar way. A scraper went up a hill that Emil had told him to go up, and the driver had told him it was too steep, he couldn't go up it. They always went around it. And Emil says, "Well, take too much time to go around it. You should just go straight up." He says, "Well, if you want me to, I will, but I can't make it." And he says, "We'll go up there." And so he did. And of course, he stalled out. And when he came backwards, he came right over the top of Emil and killed him. So they were both killed by accidents, being active in the mine at the time, you know.
In the same location, too.
Yes, both of them could have been sitting in an office in Fairbanks or someplace, you know, and just gone down to Kaysny. But they loved the mine, they loved the work, and they loved to be around the action. And they
knew
both got killed as a result of it, you know.
Certainly knew it from the ground up.
Yeah, they sure did.
Oh.
It's a funny story about that coal mine down there, though. You know, Emil worked for Cap Lathrop, and he used Cap's blacksmith shop to sharpen his picks. And on weekends and evenings, he'd go up the creek prospecting for coal. And pretty soon he found some, and he staked the coal, and he quit Cap and was producing coal as a competitor to Cap. Well, then later on, Emil Usabelli hired a young engineer from the university here. So then when Emil got his own coal, he hired this mining engineer, Abe Shallett, from the University of Alaska. And when Abe was working for Emil, he would sharpen his picks in Emil's blacksmith shop. At night and evenings, he'd go up the creek prospecting for coal, and pretty soon he found some coal, and he quit Emil and became a competitor of both Emil's and Cap Lathrop's. So I thought it was kind of ironic that each one of them
did the same thing.
That's
interesting. So we're talking about approximately the early 1960s, and getting back to your mother, I read an article in which she about your family, and said that she was mayor of Fairbanks. How did she get into local politics?
Well, I don't know if it's from her heritage back in England, but she felt that people in cities should all be active in their city government, take part in it one way or another. And if they didn't, then they couldn't complain about what happened. And so she wanted to take an active part in the city council and have something to say about city laws and regulations, and she thought everybody should do the same thing. And so it was just kind of in her heritage, I think. She just felt people should all become active in city government, and so she did. And when she became mayor, she used to remind the fellas, everybody came to the city council with a big spending program. And so then she would say to them, well, now how do you propose to pay for that without raising taxes? And that was usually the end of the conversation, because nobody had an answer to how we're going to pay for this. And you see the same problem with Clinton today. He has all kinds of answers for curing the country, but no means of getting the money to do it.
Yeah, so that problem never goes away.
That problem never goes away. As soon as you start talking money, then they have to quit talking about it.
So I guess she was the first female mayor.
First lady mayor of Fairbanks, yes.
And in her role as mayor, I'm sure she met some dignitaries passing through. Do you remember any that may have come to Fairbanks?
Well, the ones that come to mind first, and I don't know if it was actually city council business or not, but there was President Eisenhower and President Nixon, and in one case, Elliot Roosevelt, and I don't know what that occasion was, but those are the three that come to mind right now. And then, of course, there are the senators, Senator Stevens, and our delegates in Washington, D.C. She was always very close with them and worked with them as much as she could. And, of course, she took the votes to Juneau,
electoral
vote for Juneau a couple times for Nixon. And so she was always active in Washington, D.C., as well as state and city politics.
We were commenting earlier, just before we started taping, how mild this winter is and how hot our summer was, and that it's not like it used to be, according to old-timers like you.
When we were just kids in school here, we had lots of cold weather. I mean, lots from 35 to 65 below. And I can remember several times looking at the thermometer at the corner of First and Cushman on our way over to the Pioneer Brewery, where the Fairbanks North Star Brewery now is, to play hockey, and it was 38 below. And we used to say, you know, if we waited for warm weather, we might not play hockey all winter. And nowadays, we don't see that weather at all. Very seldom, and if we do see some 30 or 40, it's at night usually. So the weather is definitely changing for the better over the years. There's no doubt about it. Speaking of the weather, you know, every year there were two exciting events in town here. One was the ice breakup in the spring of the year. The minute someone decided or found some action on the Chena River with regard to the ice moving, they would get the word up to the city powerhouse, and they would blow the city whistle. And the whistle would alert everybody in town that the ice was moving, and they'd all come down to the banks of the Chena and watch the ice go out, because it was quite an event. It usually took the south end of the bridge out, and quite often there were large icebergs up on the front steps of the NC store. And then, of course, if they got an ice jam, the ice cakes and the water went all over the place. But it was quite exciting, and they always let school out when that whistle blew for the ice moving. They let school out, and all the school kids came down and watched the ice go out.
Well, did anybody make any bets when it would happen, like the Banana Ice Classic?
Well, the Banana Ice Pool was still in being in those days. It was very popular, and I think it started real early. In fact, I think it started when the railroad came through from Anchorage. A bunch of railroaders, I think, were the original instigators of the ice pool, which must have been around 19,
23, probably.
Is that when it was? Somewhere around there. Yes, they drove the Golden Spike.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And every year, you know, every spring, another exciting event, of course, was the floods. It was the flood in Fairbanks. We always had a flood. I mean, you just banked on it. You knew you were going to have a flood. And it was kind of exciting. The whole town would be full of water, you know, and all the wooden sidewalks would float around town, and the kids would all get a sidewalk and be floating around town on it. And the only thing you had to be careful of was not to get in that current of the Chena River, or else you'd have to walk back from Nenana if somebody was lucky enough to catch you down at Nenana. So it was the floods were quite an exciting time too, as well as the ice breakups.
I guess the 1937 flood was sort of the big one until we saw the one in 1967.
Yes.
Where was your house at that time in 1937?
Well, let's see. I think in 37 we were probably up at 8th and Cowles.
Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit higher, I understand, from people that lived there in those days.
Yes, it was mostly downtown where the Chena cut through. And, you know, mm-hmm. the main current was going down Wendell Avenue, you know. And of course, then it's lower around town there, too, so there was more water around mm-hmm. there. But the big one in 67, you know, we were high and dry here, but we did have water in the basement. And we could have stopped that, but we didn't because I wanted water in the basement so the basement wouldn't cave in.
Mm-hmm. You knew that from engineering.
Yes, but we had, we must have had 100 people around here for about a week when they were bringing them in from all around Slaterville here, and mm-hmm. then they'd take them by another boat over to M&O and put them on a bus and take them around Farmer's Loop to the university.
Mm-hmm.
So we had an exciting time during that flood, too.
Riverboats going up and down your street.
Yes, really.
Oh. You were on higher ground here, so it was very attractive to people to move in and build on this particular block.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, I shut the elevation of the first floor here off a mini street out there because I thought that, I told everybody it was to be high and dry for a flood, you know, but that wasn't the real reason, really. The real reason was because quite often the state or the city will fix up a new highway out there, and it's always elevated a foot or two from the original elevation of the road. So then everything that comes into it is down lower than it. So then water comes down into your area.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I thought, well, we'll build high so that if there is that case, they build that road up there. And they are talking about rejuvenating Mini Street now, the state is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose it'll be a foot or so higher than it is right now because that's usually the case. But anyhow, that was the reason for shooting the elevation of the house higher than Mini Street there mm-hmm. to keep up with it if they ever rebuilt that road and made it higher out there. And then they bring the laterals in and they make them higher,
mm-hmm.
and then everybody else is down in a hole. So we're not going to be down in a hole.
So nobody thought you had an inkling about the 67 flood that you were doing it from
engineering. No, but I didn't tell them
either. So, when did you build this house? The early 60s?
55, wasn't it? 56?
We moved in April of 55.
Mm-hmm. So, you built close to the school where your children...
Oh, yeah. We located here because of
Immaculate Conception, which mm-hmm. I guess came along after the public school that you attended. So all your children attended
ICS, yeah,
mm-hmm.
and high school.
Yeah. So they never had to take a school bus.
No.
That is a rarity this day and age.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now we're sort of looking back a few years, like 1937. Can you talk a little more about some of the characters from your childhood, some of the store owners or people that are particularly memorable for whatever reason?
Well, like most towns, we had a few characters in town here. I remember the time when the owner of the Pioneer Hotel was driving down 2nd Avenue at 3 o'clock one morning on the sidewalk. And, of course, he was caught and he was tried and they had a trial. And at the trial, he was the only sober one. His attorney was drunk and the judge was drunk, and
And everybody laughed, got a big kick out of that. And then there were three businessmen in town that decided that we were unfairly taxed, that we had taxation without representation, and so they refused to pay their taxes, federal taxes. So then the next day they were in jail. And so then they paid their taxes and they got out. But they were right because actually we were a territory and we didn't have a vote in Congress. We had a representative there, but we were taxed and we had no vote. But they were still in jail. So they paid their taxes and got out.
I hear that argument. Even now.
Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah, well, taxation without representation.
Really, it's just like the Boston Tea Party. But, there were more people involved. Had there been that many people involved this time as there was as there were in the Boston Tea Party, maybe they would have had a case or a hearing or something, you know,
so this was
to rectify the problem. But
long before statehood.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And there were only three of them, so they just put them in jail, and that was the end of it. They paid their taxes. One point that I probably should mention here is the farming in the 30s and 40s. There was quite a bit more farming than there is today in this in the Fairbanks area there. And there was a flour mill that was located where the Newsminer is now. There was a slaughterhouse where the Curling Club rink is presently situated. We had three breweries, not at the same time, but as one burned down, another one built, and so on. And two of them were on the east end of 2nd Avenue, and one was where the Fairbanks North Star Bureau Administration Building is. And then there were three farmers, three dairy farms, Kramer's, Bentley's, and Hinckley's. And they all had, as I understand it, I remember now, about between 50 and 80 cows, milking cows. And they had trucks that went around town, and in my day, when we were kids, they delivered milk around town with horses. And they had a big a bear skin rug over the milk, and they went from house to house and had a little double-ender sled that delivered from door to door. And later on, they went into, when trucks and vehicles came along, they had a van, large van with a little stove inside of it. Then with the stove and the heat in, of course, they could deliver all day. But when they had the sleds and the horses, then they had to get rid of their milk as quick as possible and get back
before
to another
trees.
Load. But there was a lot of activity in farming in those days. A lot of truck farmers, but mostly vegetables. Potatoes was the big market. And of course, they had cabbage and cauliflower, carrots, and all kinds of vegetables. So there was quite a bit of truck farming right up until till the war in 1940.
That accounts for the name of Garden Island, which is just across Illinois Street.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big truck farm.
Yes, as the original Garden Island was just about all little truck farming, vegetables.
So it was a slough.
Greenhouses and vegetables. And, uh-huh. And so the slough cut it off and made it a smaller island than we know it as today, which is surrounded by Noyes Slough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't look at it and think of it as an island.
No, you don't.
I read in some early accounts of Fairbanks that a lot of kids loved skating on the slough. Did you do that as a child?
Oh yes, I think we could skate before we could walk, and every night we were down there 6 to 10 skating on the river, you know, and. Of course, I got big enough to get into hockey. We were playing hockey probably in the 5th, 6th grade. And Can Studio, which was a musical shop there on 2nd Avenue, piped music down to the bridge. And quite a few old-timers and the older people would skate in the evening down there from 7 to 10 to this music that was piped down there from 2nd Avenue.
What did you do about lights? It would be dark.
The city put floodlights down there. Early years, we skated quite a bit in the dark. But later years, when the city got around to it, they put floodlights down there for us. And they had one or two on the bridge, mounted on the bridge. Mm-hmm. And and that was but the big lights came when the hockey rink moved up to Griffin Field, and then they put lights on both sides and lighted the whole rink.
Mm-hmm.
And there was plenty of lights then.
So you know, that was the location of the old swimming pool, Griffin?
Yes, it was.
Oh, I wish
Fairbanks.
Pretty
much that same area, right.
It's one thing you had then that we certainly don't have now.
Yes, right.
I'd be the first to patronize it. Oh. So how long was that pool in existence, the outdoor pool?
I would guess about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Ernie Fandler was the original owner. He was a Swiss. He had a brother here too, Emil and Ernie Fandler from Switzerland. And Ernie was the original owner of the swimming pool. Then he had it for about 5 or 6 years. And then we had it for about 5 years.
So this would have been in the...
That's pretty close.
30s, yeah. In the late 30s, or
that'd be all up to Warriors. The military ran it for a couple of years, mm-hmm. in 41 and 42,
mm-hmm.
and we had it probably from 37 to 36. No, we didn't have it that early.
Yeah.
We had it. Since probably then, Ernie had it probably from around 37 or 38, huh?
Were you in high school? Was there? I don't think.
40 to 48.
40 to 48 that you had it.
Oh yeah, I think it was 50.
Mm-hmm. 50? 40 to
50? Well, anyway, I think
that's 10 years. That was
right.
A good guess.
Yeah, you got right in there at 10 years. So I think that's a loss to the community, because we certainly have had a lot of hot days this summer when it would have been packed.
Yeah, really.
Swimming outdoors.
I agree with you. Swimming outdoors is much nicer.
Much nicer.
It's like tennis. Tennis is much nicer outdoors than in a gymnasium.
Definitely a summer sport.
Yes.
Now they're making it year-round.
Yeah.
I just happened to read an article in the newspaper about you when you were selected the Family of the Year during the 1988 Ice Festival, and I especially like the quote you had, Rose, said, "We love it here. There's no better place to live and to raise a family." I think that's really nice. And by family, how many children did you have? You
said we have nine.
Nine children, and they all went to local school.
ICS in Monroe High School. Uh-huh.
And some of them are graduates of the University of Alaska, too?
Well, most of them went outside, really. I think Celia was the only one who graduated here, wasn't she? All of them but two graduated from universities outside.
Mm-hmm.
They went to Seattle University and Gonzaga and Spokane and Santa Clara, California.
Mm-hmm.
And Northern Colorado University. Greeley, is it?
Did they come back to live here in the community?
Oh, yes, they all came.
Agree with your wife's quote that it's a pretty nice place to be, and I guess they are raising their families here.
Yes, we have five here, mm-hmm. One in Anchorage, one is still in school in the university, and in San Jose, and one in Dallas, and one in Florida.
So, nice place to go in the summer, or in the winter time.
Yeah, they're all back here but three, and those three wish they were back here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've enjoyed talking to you and hearing about the early days and your experiences growing up in Fairbanks and your lifelong commitment to Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you.